This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history, by John M. Barry, read by Scott Brick. Prologue. The Great War had brought Paul Lewis into the Navy in 1918 as a lieutenant commander, but he never seemed quite at ease when in his uniform. It never seemed to fit quite right, or to sit quite right, and he was often flustered and failed to respond properly when sailors saluted him. Yet he was every bit a warrior, and he hunted death. When he found it, he confronted it, challenged it, tried to pin it in place like a lepidopterist pinning down a butterfly, so he could then dissect it piece by piece, analyze it, and find a way to confound it. He did so often enough that the risks he took became routine. Still, death had never appeared to him as it did now, in mid-September 1918. Row after row of men confronted him in the hospital ward, many of them bloody and dying in some new and awful way. He had been called here to solve a mystery that dumbfounded the clinicians, for Lewis was a scientist. Although a physician, he had never practiced on a patient. Instead, a member of the very first generation of American medical scientists, he had spent his life in the laboratory. He had already built an extraordinary career, an international reputation, and he was still young enough to be seen as just coming into his prime. A decade earlier, working with his mentor at the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, he had proved that a virus caused polio, a discovery still considered a landmark achievement in the history of virology. He had then developed a vaccine that protected monkeys from polio with nearly 100% effectiveness. That and other successes had won him the position of founding head of the Henry Phipps Institute, a research institute associated with the University of Pennsylvania. And in 1917, he had been chosen for the great honor of giving the annual Harvey Lecture. It seemed only the first of many honors that would come his way. Today, the children of two prominent scientists who knew him then and who crossed paths with many Nobel laureates say their fathers each told them that Lewis was the smartest man they had ever met. The clinicians now looked to him to explain the violent symptoms these sailors presented. The blood that covered so many of them did not come from wounds, at least not from steel or explosives that had torn away limbs. Most of the blood had come from nosebleeds. A few sailors had coughed the blood up. Others had bled from their ears. Some coughed so hard that autopsies would later show they had torn apart abdominal muscles and rib cartilage. And many of the men writhed in agony or delirium. Nearly all those able to communicate complained of headache, as if someone were hammering a wedge into their skulls just behind the eyes, and body aches so intense they felt like bones breaking. A few were vomiting. Finally, the skin of some of the sailors had turned unusual colors. Some showed just a tinge of blue around their lips or fingertips, but a few looked so dark one could not tell easily if they were Caucasian or Negro. They looked almost black. Only once had Lewis seen a disease that in any way resembled this. 2 months earlier, members of the crew of a British ship had been taken by ambulance from a sealed dock to another Philadelphia hospital and placed in isolation. There, many of that crew had died. At autopsy, their lungs had resembled those of men who had died from poison gas or pneumonic plague, a more virulent form of bubonic plague. Whatever those crewmen had had, it had not spread. No one else had gotten sick. But the men in the wards now not only puzzled Lewis. They had to have chilled him with fear also, fear both for himself and for what this disease could do. For whatever was attacking these sailors was not only spreading, it was spreading explosively. And it was spreading despite a well-planned, concerted effort to contain it. This same disease had erupted 10 days earlier at a Navy facility in Boston. Lieutenant Commander Milton Rosenau at the Chelsea Naval Hospital there had certainly communicated to Lewis, whom he knew well, about it. Rosenau, too, was a scientist who had chosen to leave a Harvard professorship for the Navy when the United States entered the war, and his textbook on public health was called The Bible by both Army and Navy military doctors. Philadelphia Navy authorities had taken Rosenau's warnings seriously, especially since a detachment of sailors had just arrived from Boston, and they had made preparations to isolate any ill sailors should an outbreak occur. They had been confident that isolation would control it. Yet 4 days after that Boston detachment arrived, 19 sailors in Philadelphia were hospitalized with what looked like the same disease. Despite their immediate isolation and that of everyone with whom they had had contact, 87 sailors were hospitalized the next day. They and their contacts were again isolated. But 2 days later, 600 men were hospitalized with this strange disease. The hospital ran out of empty beds, and hospital staff began falling ill. The Navy then began sending hundreds more sick sailors to a civilian hospital. And sailors and civilian workers were moving constantly between the city and Navy facilities, as they had in Boston. Meanwhile, personnel from Boston, and now Philadelphia, had been and were being sent throughout the country as well. That had to chill Lewis, too. Lewis had visited the first patients, taken blood, urine, and sputum samples, done nasal washings, and swabbed their throats. Then he had come back again to repeat the process of collecting samples and to study the symptoms for any further clues. In his laboratory, he and everyone under him poured their energies into growing and identifying whatever pathogen was making the men sick. He needed to find the pathogen. He needed to find the cause of the disease. And even more, he needed to make a curative serum or a preventive vaccine. Lewis loved the laboratory more than he loved anyone or anything. His workspace was crammed. It looked like a thicket of icicles. Test tubes in racks, stacked petri dishes, pipettes. But it warmed him, gave him as much and perhaps more comfort than did his home and family. But he did not love working like this. The pressure to find an answer did not bother him. Much of his polio research had been conducted in the midst of an epidemic so extreme that New York City had required people to obtain passes to travel. What did bother him was the need to abandon good science. To succeed in preparing either a vaccine or serum, he would have to make a series of guesses based on, at best, inconclusive results. And each guess would have to be right. He had already made one guess. If he did not yet know precisely what caused the disease, nor how or whether he could prevent it or cure it, he believed he knew what the disease was. He believed it was influenza, although an influenza unlike any known before. Lewis was correct. In 1918, an influenza virus emerged, probably in the United States, that would spread around the world, and one of its earliest appearances in lethal form came in Philadelphia. Before that worldwide pandemic faded away in 1920, it would kill more people than any other outbreak of disease in human history. Plague in the 1300s killed a far larger proportion of the population, more than one quarter of Europe, but in raw numbers, influenza killed more than plague then, more than AIDS today. The lowest estimate of the pandemic's worldwide death toll is 21 million, in a world with a population less than one-third today's. That estimate comes from a contemporary study of the disease, and newspapers have often cited it since, but it is almost certainly wrong. Epidemiologists today estimate that influenza likely caused at least 50 million deaths worldwide, and possibly as many as 100 million. Yet even that number understates the horror of the disease, a horror contained in other data. Normally, influenza chiefly kills the elderly and infants, but in the 1918 pandemic, roughly half of those who died were young men and women in the prime of their life, in their 20s and 30s. Harvey Cushing, then a brilliant young surgeon who would go on to great fame, and who himself fell desperately ill with influenza and never fully recovered from what was likely a complication, would call these victims doubly dead in that they died so young. One cannot know with certainty, but if the upper estimate of the death toll is true, as many as 8 to 10% of all young adults then living may have been killed by the virus. And they died with extraordinary ferocity and speed. Although the influenza pandemic stretched over 2 years, perhaps 2/3 of the deaths occurred in a period of 24 weeks, and more than half of those deaths occurred in even less time, from mid-September to early December 1918. Influenza killed more people in a year than the Black Death of the Middle Ages killed in a century. It killed more people in 24 weeks than AIDS has killed in 24 years. The influenza pandemic resembled both of those scourges in other ways also. Like AIDS, it killed those with the most to live for. And as priests had done in the bubonic plague, in 1918, even in Philadelphia, as modern a city as existed in the world, priests would drive horse-drawn wagons down the streets, calling upon those behind doors shut tight in terror to bring out their dead. Yet the story of the 1918 influenza virus is not simply one of havoc, death, and desolation, of a society fighting a war against nature superimposed on a war against another human society. It is also a story of science, of discovery, of how one thinks, and of how one changes the way one thinks, of how amidst near-utter chaos a few men sought the coolness of contemplation, the utter calm that precedes not philosophizing, but grim, determined action. For the influenza pandemic that erupted in 1918 was the first great collision between nature and modern science. It was the first great collision between a natural force and a society that included individuals who refused either to submit to that force or to simply call upon divine intervention to save themselves from it. Individuals who instead were determined to confront this force directly with a developing technology and with their minds. In the United States, the story is particularly one of a handful of extraordinary people, of whom Paul Lewis is one. These were men and some very few women who, far from being backward, had already developed the fundamental science upon which much of today's medicine is based. They had already developed vaccines and antitoxins and techniques still in use. They had already pushed, in some cases, close to the edge of knowledge today. In a way, these researchers had spent much of their lives preparing for the confrontation that occurred in 1918, not only in general, but, for a few of them at least, quite specifically. In every war in American history so far, disease had killed more soldiers than combat. In many wars throughout history, war had spread disease. The leaders of American research had anticipated that a major epidemic of some kind would erupt during the Great War. They had prepared for it as much as it was possible to prepare. Then, they waited for it to strike. The story, however, begins earlier. Before medicine could confront this disease with any promise of effect, it had to become scientific. It had to be revolutionized. Medicine is not yet and may never be fully a science. The idiosyncrasies, physical and otherwise, of individual patients and doctors may prevent that. But up to a few decades before World War I, the practice of medicine had remained quite literally almost unchanged from the time of Hippocrates, more than 2,000 years earlier. Then, in Europe first, medical science changed and, finally, the practice of medicine changed. But even after European medicine changed, medicine in the United States did not. In research and education especially, American medicine lagged far behind, and that made practice lag as well. While for decades European medical schools had, for example, required students to have a solid background in chemistry, biology, and other sciences, as late as 1900, it was more difficult to get into a respectable American college than into an American medical school. At least 100 U.S. medical schools would accept any man, but not woman, willing to pay tuition. At most, 20% of the schools required even a high school diploma for admission, much less any academic training in science, and only a single medical school required its students to have a college degree. Nor, once students entered, did American schools necessarily make up for any lack of scientific background. Many schools bestowed a medical degree upon students who simply attended lectures and passed examinations. In sum, students could fail several courses, never touch a single patient, and still get a medical degree. Not until late, very late in the 19th century, did a virtual handful of leaders of American medical science begin to plan a revolution that transformed American medicine from the most backward in the developed world into the best in the world. William James, who was a friend of, and whose son would work for, several of these men, wrote that the collecting of a critical mass of men of genius could make a whole civilization vibrate and shake. These men intended to, and would, shake the world. To do so required not only intelligence and training, but real courage. The courage to relinquish all support and all authority. Or perhaps it required only recklessness. In Faust, Goethe wrote, "'Tis writ, in the beginning was the word. I pause, to wonder what is here inferred. The word I cannot set supremely high. A new translation I will try. I read, if by the Spirit I am taught, this sense. In the beginning was the thought." Upon the word rested authority, stability, and law. The thought, roiled and ripped apart and created, without knowledge or concern of what it would create. Shortly before the Great War began, the men who so wanted to transform American medicine succeeded. They created a system that could produce people capable of thinking in a new way, capable of challenging the natural order. They, together with the first generation of scientists they had trained, Paul Lewis and his few peers, formed a cadre who stood on alert, hoping against but expecting and preparing for the eruption of an epidemic. When it came, they placed their lives in the path of the disease and applied all their knowledge and powers to defeat it. As it overwhelmed them, they concentrated on constructing the body of knowledge necessary to eventually triumph. For the scientific knowledge that ultimately came out of the influenza pandemic pointed directly, and still points, to much that lies in medicine's future. Part 1. The Warriors. Chapter 1. On September 12, 1876, the crowd overflowing the auditorium of Baltimore's Academy of Music was in a mood of hopeful excitement, but excitement without frivolity. Indeed, despite an unusual number of women in attendance, many of them from the uppermost reaches of local society, a reporter noted there was no display of dress or fashion. For this occasion had serious purpose. It was to mark the launching of the Johns Hopkins University, an institution whose leaders intended not simply to found a new university, but to change all of American education. Indeed, they sought considerably more than that. They planned to change the way in which Americans tried to understand and grapple with nature. The keynote speaker, the English scientist Thomas H. Huxley, personified their goals. The import was not lost on the nation. Many newspapers, including the New York Times, had reporters covering this event. After it, they would print Huxley's address in full. for the nation was then, as it so often has been, at war with itself. In fact, it was engaged in different wars simultaneously, each being waged on several fronts, wars that ran along the fault lines of modern America. One involved expansion and race. In the Dakotas, George Armstrong Custer had just led the 7th Cavalry to its destruction at the hands of primitive savages resisting encroachment of the white man. The day Huxley spoke, the front page of the Washington Star reported that the hostile Sioux, well-fed and well-armed, had just carried out a massacre of miners. In the South, a far more important but equally savage war was being waged as white Democrats sought redemption from Reconstruction in anticipation of the presidential election. Throughout the South, rifle clubs, saber clubs, and rifle teams of former Confederates were being organized into infantry and cavalry units. Already accounts of intimidation, beatings, whippings, and murder directed against Republicans and blacks had surfaced. After the murder of 300 black men in a single Mississippi county, one man, convinced that words from the Democrats' own mouths would convince the world of their design, pleaded with the New York Times, "For God's sake, publish the testimony of the Democrats before the grand jury." Voting returns had already begun to come in. There was no single national election day. And 2 months later, Democrat Samuel Tilden would win the popular vote by a comfortable margin. But he would never take office as president. Instead, the Republican Secretary of War would threaten to force a reversal of the vote. Federal troops with fixed bayonets would patrol Washington, and Southerners would talk of reigniting the Civil War. That crisis would ultimately be resolved through an extra-constitutional special committee and a political understanding. Republicans would discard the voting returns of 3 states, Louisiana, Florida, South Carolina, and seize a single disputed electoral vote in Oregon to keep the presidency in the person of Rutherford B. Hayes. But they also would withdraw all federal troops from the South and cease intervening in Southern affairs, leaving the Negroes there to fend for themselves. The war involving the Hopkins was more muted, but no less profound. The outcome would help define one element of the character of the nation, the extent to which the nation would accept or reject modern science, and, to a lesser degree, how secular it would become, how godly it would remain. Precisely at 11 a.m., a procession of people advanced upon the stage. First came Daniel Coit Gilman, president of the Hopkins, and on his arm was Huxley. Following in single file came the governor, the mayor, and other notables. As they took their seats, the conversations in the audience quickly died away, replaced by expectancy of a kind of declaration of war. Of medium height and middle age, though he already had iron-gray hair and nearly white whiskers, and possessed of what was described as a pleasant face, Huxley did not look the warrior. But he had a warrior's ruthlessness. His dicta included the pronouncement, "The foundation of morality is to have done, once and for all, with lying." A brilliant scientist, later president of the Royal Society, he advised investigators, "Sit down before a fact as a little child. Be prepared to give up every preconceived notion. Follow humbly wherever and to whatever abysses nature leads, or you shall learn nothing." He also believed that learning had purpose, stating, "The great end of life is not knowledge, but action." To act upon the world himself, he became a proselytizer for faith in human reason. By 1876, he had become the world's foremost advocate of the theory of evolution and of science itself. Indeed, H. L. Mencken said that it was he, more than any other man, who worked that great change in human thought which marked the 19th century. Now, President Gilman gave a brief and simple introduction. Then, Professor Huxley began to speak. Normally, he lectured on evolution, but today he was speaking on a subject of even greater magnitude. He was speaking about the process of intellectual inquiry. The Hopkins was to be unlike any other university in America. Aiming almost exclusively at the education of graduate students and the furtherance of science, it was intended by its trustees to rival not Harvard or Yale, neither of them considered worthy of emulation, but the greatest institutions of Europe, and particularly Germany. Perhaps only in the United States, a nation ever in the act of creating itself, could such an institution come into existence, both so fully formed in concept and already so renowned, even before the foundation of a single building had been laid. His voice was low, clear, and distinct, reported one listener. The audience paid the closest attention to every word which fell from the lecturer's lips, occasionally manifesting their approval by applause. Said another, "Professor Huxley's method is slow, precise, and clear, and he guards the positions which he takes with astuteness and ability. He does not utter anything in the reckless fashion which conviction sometimes countenances and excuses, but rather with the deliberation that research and close inquiry foster." Huxley commended the bold goals of the Hopkins, expounded upon his own theories of education, theories that soon informed those of William James and John Dewey, and extolled the fact that the existence of the Hopkins meant, finally, that neither political nor ecclesiastical sectarianism would interfere with the pursuit of the truth. In truth, Huxley's speech, read a century and a quarter later, seems remarkably tame. Yet Huxley and the entire ceremony left an impression in the country deep enough that Gilman would spend years trying to edge away from it, even while simultaneously trying to fulfill the goals Huxley applauded. For the ceremony's most significant word was one not spoken. Not a single participant uttered the word God or made any reference to the Almighty. This spectacular omission scandalized those who worried about or rejected a mechanistic and necessarily godless view of the universe. And it came in an era in which American universities had nearly 200 endowed chairs of theology and fewer than 5 in medicine. An era in which the president of Drew University had said that, after much study and experience, he had concluded that only ministers of the gospel should be college professors. The omission also served as a declaration. The Hopkins would pursue the truth, no matter to what abyss it led. In no area did the truth threaten so much as in the study of life. In no area did the United States lag behind the rest of the world so much as in its study of the life sciences and medicine. And in that area in particular, the influence of the Hopkins would be immense. By 1918, as America marched into war, the nation had come not only to rely upon the changes wrought largely, though certainly not entirely, by men associated with the Hopkins. The United States Army had mobilized these men into a special force, focused and disciplined, ready to hurl themselves at an enemy. The two most important questions in science are, what can I know, and how can I know it? Science and religion, in fact, part ways over the first question, what each can know. Religion, and to some extent philosophy, believes it can know, or at least address the question, why? For most religions, the answer to this question ultimately comes down to the way God ordered it. Religion is inherently conservative. Even one proposing a new God only creates a new order. The question why is too deep for science. Science instead believes it can only learn how something occurs. The revolution of modern science, and especially medical science, began as science not only focused on this answer to what can I know, but more importantly, changed its method of inquiry, changed its answer to how can I know it. This answer involves not simply academic pursuits. It affects how a society governs itself, its structure, how its citizens live. If a society does set Goethe's word supremely high, if it believes that it knows the truth and that it need not question its beliefs, then that society is more likely to enforce rigid decrees and less likely to change. If it leaves room for doubt about the truth, it is more likely to be free and open. In the narrower context of science, the answer determines how individuals explore nature, how one does science. And the way one goes about answering a question, one's methodology, matters as much as the question itself. For the method of inquiry underlies knowledge and often determines what one discovers. How one pursues a question often dictates, or at least limits, the answer. Indeed, methodology matters more than anything else. Methodology subsumes, for example, Thomas Kuhn's well-known theory of how science advances. Kuhn gave the word paradigm wide usage by arguing that at any given point in time, a particular paradigm, a kind of perceived truth, dominates the thinking in any science. Others have applied his concept to non-scientific fields as well. According to Kuhn, the prevailing paradigm tends to freeze progress, indirectly by creating a mental obstacle to creative ideas, and directly by, for example, blocking research funds from going to truly new ideas, especially if they conflict with the paradigm. He argues that nonetheless researchers eventually find what he calls anomalies that do not fit the paradigm. Each one erodes the foundation of the paradigm, and when enough accrue to undermine it, the paradigm collapses. Scientists then cast about for a new paradigm that explains both the old and new facts. But the process and progress of science is more fluid than Kuhn's concept suggests. It moves more like an amoeba, with soft and ill-defined edges. More importantly, method matters. Kuhn's own theory recognizes that the propelling force behind the movement from one explanation to another comes from the methodology, from what we call the scientific method. But he takes as an axiom that those who ask questions constantly test existing hypotheses. In fact, with a methodology that probes and tests hypotheses, regardless of any paradigm, progress is inevitable. Without such a methodology, progress becomes merely coincidental. Yet the scientific method has not always been used by those who inquire into nature. Through most of known history, investigators trying to penetrate the natural world, penetrate what we call science, relied upon the mind alone, reason alone. These investigators believed that they could know a thing if their knowledge followed logically from what they considered a sound premise. In turn, they based their premises chiefly on observation. This commitment to logic, coupled with man's ambition to see the entire world in a comprehensive and cohesive way, actually imposed blinders on science in general and on medicine in particular. The chief enemy of progress, ironically, became pure reason. And for the bulk of 2.5 millennia, 2,500 years, the actual treatment of patients by physicians made almost no progress at all. One cannot blame religion or superstition for this lack of progress. In the West, beginning at least 500 years before the birth of Christ, medicine was largely secular. While Hippocratic healers, the various Hippocratic texts were written by different people, did run temples and accept pluralistic explanations for disease, they pushed for material explanations. Hippocrates himself was born in approximately 460 BC. On the Sacred Disease, one of the more famous Hippocratic texts and one often attributed to him directly, even mocked theories that attributed epilepsy to the intervention of gods. He and his followers advocated precise observation, then theorizing. As the texts stated, For a theory is a composite memory of things apprehended with sense perception. But conclusions which are merely verbal cannot bear fruit. I approve of theorizing also if it lays its foundation in incident and deduces its conclusion in accordance with phenomena. But if such an approach sounds like that of a modern investigator, a modern scientist, it lacked two singularly important elements. First, Hippocrates and his associates merely observed nature. They did not probe it. This failure to probe nature was to some extent understandable. To dissect a human body then was inconceivable. But the authors of the Hippocratic texts did not test their conclusions and theories. A theory must make a prediction to be useful or scientific. Ultimately, it must say, if this, then that. And testing that prediction is the single most important element of modern methodology. Once that prediction is tested, it must advance another one for testing. It can never stand still. Those who wrote the Hippocratic texts, however, observed passively and reasoned actively. Their careful observations noted mucus discharges, menstrual bleeding, watery evacuations in dysentery, and they very likely observed blood left to stand, which over time separates into several layers, one nearly clear, one of somewhat yellowy serum, one of darker blood. Based on these observations, they hypothesized that there were four kinds of bodily fluids, or humors: blood, phlegm, bile, and black bile. This terminology survives today in the phrase humoral immunity, which refers to elements of the immune system, such as antibodies, that circulate in the blood. This hypothesis made sense, comported with observations, and could explain many symptoms. It explained, for example, that coughs were caused by the flow of phlegm to the chest. Observations of people coughing up phlegm certainly supported this conclusion. In a far broader sense, the hypothesis also conformed to the ways in which the Greeks saw nature. They observed four seasons, four aspects of the environment: cold, hot, wet, and dry, and four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. Medicine waited 600 years for the next major advance, for Galen. But Galen did not break from these teachings. He systematized them, perfected them. Galen claimed, "I have done as much for medicine as Trajan did for the Roman Empire when he built the bridges and roads through Italy. It is I and I alone who have revealed the true path of medicine." It must be admitted that Hippocrates already staked out this path. He prepared the way, but I have made it possible. Galen did not simply observe passively. He dissected animals and, although he did not perform autopsies on humans, served as a physician to gladiators whose wounds allowed him to see deep beneath the skin. Thus, his anatomic knowledge went far beyond that of any known predecessor. But he remained chiefly a theoretician, a logician. He imposed order on the Hippocratic body of work, reconciling conflicts, reasoning so clearly that if one accepted his premises, his conclusions seemed inevitable. He made the humoral theory perfectly logical and even elegant. As historian Vivian Nutton notes, he raised the theory to a truly conceptual level, separating the humors from direct correlation with bodily fluids and making them invisible entities recognizable only by logic. Galen's works were translated into Arabic and underlay both Western and Islamic medicine for nearly 1,500 years before facing any significant challenge. Like the Hippocratic writers, Galen believed that illness was essentially the result of an imbalance in the body. He also thought that balance could be restored by intervention. A physician thus could treat a disease successfully. If there was a poison in the body, then the poison could be removed by evacuation. Sweating, urinating, defecating, and vomiting were all ways that could restore balance. Such beliefs led physicians to recommend violent laxatives and other purgatives, as well as mustard plasters and other prescriptions that punished the body, that blistered it and theoretically restored balance. And of all the practices of medicine over the centuries, one of the most enduring, yet least understandable to us today, was a perfectly logical extension of Hippocratic and Galenic thought, and recommended by both. This practice was bleeding patients. Bleeding was among the most common therapies employed to treat all manner of disorders. Deep into the 19th century, Hippocrates and most of those who followed him also believed that natural processes must not be interfered with. The various kinds of purging were meant to augment and accelerate natural processes, not resist them. Since pus, for example, was routinely seen in all kinds of wounds, pus was seen as a necessary part of healing. Until the late 1800s, physicians routinely would do nothing to avoid the generation of pus and were reluctant even to drain it. Instead, they referred to laudable pus. Similarly, Hippocrates scorned surgery as intrusive, as interfering with nature's course. Further, he saw it as a purely mechanical skill, beneath the calling of physicians who dealt in a far more intellectual realm. This intellectual arrogance would subsume the attitude of Western physicians for more than 2,000 years. This is not to say that for 2,000 years, the Hippocratic texts and Galen offered the only theoretical constructs to explain health and disease. Many ideas and theories were advanced about how the body worked, how illness developed. And a rival school of thought gradually developed within the Hippocratic Galenic tradition that valued experience and empiricism and challenged the purely theoretical. It is impossible to summarize all these theories in a few sentences, yet nearly all of them did share certain concepts. That health was a state of equilibrium and balance, and that illness resulted either from an internal imbalance within the body or from external environmental influences, such as an atmospheric miasma or some combination of both. But in the early 1500s, three men began to challenge at least the methods of medicine. Paracelsus declared he would investigate nature not by following that which those of old taught, but by our own observation of nature, confirmed by experiment and by reasoning thereon. Vesalius dissected human corpses and concluded that Galen's findings had come from animals and were deeply flawed. His De Humani Corporis Fabrica, likely illustrated by a student of Titian, became a cornerstone of the Renaissance. Fracastorius, an astronomer, mathematician, botanist, and poet, meanwhile hypothesized that diseases had specific causes and that contagion passes from one thing to another and is originally caused by infection of the imperceptible particle. One medical historian called his body of work a peak maybe unequaled by anyone between Hippocrates and Pasteur. The contemporaries of these three men included Martin Luther and Copernicus, men who changed the world. In medicine, the new ideas of Paracelsus, Vesalius, and Fracastorius did not change the world. In the actual practice of medicine, they changed nothing at all. But the approach they called for did create ripples, while the scholasticism of the Middle Ages that stultified nearly all fields of inquiry was beginning to decay. In 1605, Francis Bacon, in Novum Organum, attacked the purely deductive reasoning of logic, calling Aristotle a mere bondservant to his logic, thereby rendering it contentious and well-nigh useless. He also complained, "The logic now in use serves rather to fix and give stability to the errors which have their foundation in commonly received notions than to help the search after truth. So it does more harm than good." In 1628, Harvey traced the circulation of the blood, arguably perhaps the single greatest achievement of medicine, and certainly the greatest achievement until the late 1800s. And Europe was in intellectual ferment. Half a century later, Newton revolutionized physics and mathematics. Newton's contemporary John Locke, trained as a physician, emphasized the pursuit of knowledge through experience. In 1753, James Lind conducted a pioneering controlled experiment among British sailors and demonstrated that scurvy could be prevented by eating limes. Ever since, the British have been called limeys. David Hume, after this demonstration and following Locke, led a movement of empiricism. His contemporary John Hunter made a brilliant scientific study of surgery, elevating it from a barber's craft. Hunter also performed model scientific experiments, including some on himself, as when he infected himself with pus from a gonorrheal case to prove a hypothesis. Then in 1798, Edward Jenner, a student of Hunter's, Hunter had told him, "Don't think, try," published his work. As a young medical student, Jenner had heard a milkmaid say, "I cannot take the smallpox because I have had cowpox." The cowpox virus resembles smallpox so closely that exposure to cowpox gives immunity to smallpox. But cowpox itself only rarely develops into a serious disease. The virus that causes cowpox is called vaccinia, taking its name from vaccination. Jenner's work with cowpox was a landmark, but not because he was the first to immunize people against smallpox. In China, India, and Persia, different techniques had long since been developed to expose children to smallpox and make them immune. And in Europe, at least as early as the 1500s, laypeople, not physicians, took material from a pustule of those with a mild case of smallpox and scratched it into the skin of those who had not yet caught the disease. Most people infected this way developed mild cases and became immune. In 1721 in Massachusetts, Cotton Mather took the advice of an African slave, tried this technique, and staved off a lethal epidemic. But variolation could kill. Vaccinating with cowpox was far safer than variolation. From a scientific standpoint, however, Jenner's most important contribution was his rigorous methodology. Of his finding, he said, "I placed it upon a rock where I knew it would be immovable before I invited the public to take a look at it." But ideas die hard. Even as Jenner was conducting his experiments, despite the vast increase in knowledge of the body derived from Harvey and Hunter, medical practice had barely changed. And many, if not most, physicians who thought deeply about medicine still saw it in terms of logic and observation alone. In Philadelphia, 2,200 years after Hippocrates and 1,600 years after Galen, Benjamin Rush, a pioneer in his views on mental illness, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and America's most prominent physician, still applied logic and observation alone to build a more simple and consistent system of medicine than the world had yet seen. In 1796, he advanced a hypothesis as logical and elegant, he believed, as Newtonian physics. Observing that all fevers were associated with flushed skin, he concluded that this was caused by distended capillaries and reasoned that the proximate cause of fever must be abnormal, convulsive action in these vessels. He took this a step further and concluded that all fevers resulted from disturbance of capillaries, and, since the capillaries were part of the circulatory system, he concluded that a hypertension of the entire circulatory system was involved. Rush proposed to reduce this convulsive action by depletion, that is, venesection, bleeding. It made perfect sense. He was one of the most aggressive of the advocates of heroic medicine. The heroism, of course, was found in the patient. In the early 1800s, praise for his theories was heard throughout Europe, and one London physician said Rush united in an almost unprecedented degree sagacity and judgment. A reminder of the medical establishment's acceptance of bleeding exists today in the name of the British journal The Lancet, one of the leading medical journals in the world. A lancet was the instrument physicians used to cut into a patient's vein. But if the first failing of medicine, a failing that endured virtually unchallenged for 2 millennia and then only gradually eroded over the next 3 centuries, was that it did not probe nature through experiments, that it simply observed and reasoned from observation to a conclusion, that failing was, finally, about to be corrected. What can I know? How can I know it? If reason alone could solve mathematical problems, if Newton could think his way through physics, then why could not man reason out the ways in which the body worked? Why did reason alone fail so utterly in medicine? One explanation is that Hippocratic and Galenic theory did offer a system of therapeutics that seemed to produce the desired effect. They seemed to work. So the Hippocratic-Galenic model lasted so long not only because of its logical consistency, but because its therapies seemed to have effect. Indeed, bleeding, today called phlebotomy, can actually help in some rare diseases, such as polycythemia, a rare genetic disorder that causes people to make too much blood, or hemochromatosis, when the blood carries too much iron. And in far more common cases of acute pulmonary edema, when the lungs fill with fluid, it could relieve immediate symptoms and is still sometimes tried. For example, in congestive heart failure, excess fluid in the lungs can make victims extremely uncomfortable and, ultimately, kill them if the heart cannot pump the fluid out. When people suffering from these conditions were bled, they may well have been helped. This reinforced theory. Even when physicians observed that bleeding weakened the patient, that weakening could still seem positive. If a patient was flushed with a fever, it followed logically that if bleeding alleviated those symptoms, making the patient pale, it was a good thing. If it made the patient pale, it worked. Finally, a euphoric feeling sometimes accompanies blood loss. This, too, reinforced theory. So bleeding both made logical sense in the Hippocratic and Galenic systems, and sometimes gave physicians and patients positive reinforcement. Other therapies also did what they were designed to do, in a sense. As late as the 19th century, until well after the Civil War in the United States, most physicians and patients still saw the body only as an interdependent whole. Still saw a specific symptom as a result of an imbalance or disequilibrium in the entire body. Still saw illness chiefly as something within and generated by the body itself. As the historian Charles Rosenberg has pointed out, even smallpox, despite its known clinical course and the fact that vaccination prevented it, was still seen as a manifestation of a systemic ill. And medical traditions outside the Hippocratic-Galenic model, from the subluxations of chiropractic to the yin and yang of Chinese medicine, have also tended to see disease as a result of imbalance within the body. Physicians and patients wanted therapies to augment and accelerate, not block, the natural course of disease, the natural healing process. The state of the body could be altered by prescribing such toxic substances as mercury, arsenic, antimony, and iodine. Therapies designed to blister the body did so. Therapies designed to produce sweating or vomiting did so. One doctor, for example, when confronted with a case of pleurisy, gave camphor and recorded that the case was suddenly relieved by profuse perspiration. His intervention, he believed, had cured. Yet a patient's improvement, of course, does not prove that a therapy works. For example, the 1889 edition of the Merck Manual of Medical Information recommended 100 treatments for bronchitis, each one with its fervent believers, yet the current editor of the manual recognizes that none of them worked. The manual also recommended, among other things, champagne, strychnine, and nitroglycerin for seasickness. And when a therapy clearly did not work, the intricacies and intimacies of the doctor-patient relationship also came into play, injecting emotion into the equation. One truth has not changed from the time of Hippocrates until today. When faced with desperate patients, doctors often do not have the heart, or more accurately, they have too much heart to do nothing. And so a doctor, as desperate as the patient, may try anything, including things he or she knows will not work, as long as they will not harm. At the least, the patient will get some solace. One cancer specialist concedes, "I do virtually the same thing myself. If I'm treating a teary, desperate patient, I will try low-dose alpha interferon, even though I do not believe it has ever cured a single person. It doesn't have side effects, and it gives the patient hope." Cancer provides other examples as well. No truly scientific evidence shows that echinacea has any effect on cancer, yet it is widely prescribed in Germany today for terminal cancer patients. Japanese physicians routinely prescribe placebos in treatment. Steven Rosenberg, a National Cancer Institute scientist who was the first person to stimulate the immune system to cure cancer and who led the team that performed the first human gene therapy experiments, points out that for years, chemotherapy was recommended to virtually all victims of pancreatic cancer, even though not a single chemotherapy regimen had ever been shown to prolong their lives for one day. At this writing, investigators have just demonstrated that gemcitabine can extend median life expectancy by 1 to 2 months, but it is highly toxic. Another explanation for the failure of logic and observation alone to advance medicine is that unlike, say, physics, which uses a form of logic, mathematics, as its natural language, biology does not lend itself to logic. Leo Szilard, a prominent physicist, made this point when he complained that after switching from physics to biology, he never had a peaceful bath again. As a physicist, he would soak in the warmth of a bathtub and contemplate a problem, turn it in his mind, reason his way through it. But once he became a biologist, he constantly had to climb out of the bathtub to look up a fact. In fact, biology is chaos. Biological systems are the product not of logic but of evolution, an inelegant process. Life does not choose the logically best design to meet a new situation. It adapts what already exists. Much of the human genome includes genes which are conserved, that is, which are essentially the same as those in much simpler species. Evolution has built upon what already exists. The result, unlike the clean, straight lines of logic, is often irregular, messy. An analogy might be building an energy-efficient farmhouse. If one starts from scratch, logic would impel the use of certain building materials, the design of windows and doors with kilowatt hours in mind, perhaps the inclusion of solar panels on the roof, and so on. But if one wants to make an 18th-century farmhouse energy-efficient, one adapts it as well as possible. One proceeds logically, doing things that make good sense given what one starts with, given the existing farmhouse. One seals and caulks and insulates and puts in a new furnace or heat pump. The old farmhouse will be, maybe, the best one could do given where one started, but it will be irregular. In window size, in ceiling height, in building materials, it will bear little resemblance to a new farmhouse designed from scratch for maximum energy efficiency. For logic to be of use in biology, one has to apply it from a given starting point, using the then extant rules of the game. Hence, Szilard had to climb out of the bathtub to look up a fact. Ultimately, then, logic and observation failed to penetrate the workings of the body not because of the power of the Hippocratic hypothesis, the Hippocratic paradigm. Logic and observation failed because neither one tested the hypothesis rigorously. Once investigators began to apply something akin to the modern scientific method, the old hypothesis collapsed. By 1800, enormous advances had been made in other sciences, beginning centuries earlier with a revolution in the use of quantitative measurement. Bacon and Descartes, although opposites in their views of the usefulness of pure logic, had both provided a philosophical framework for new ways of seeing the natural world. Newton had, in a way, bridged their differences, advancing mathematics through logic while relying upon experiment and observation for confirmation. Joseph Priestley, Henry Cavendish, and Antoine Léon Lavoisier created modern chemistry and penetrated the natural world. Particularly important for biology was Lavoisier's decoding of the chemistry of combustion and use of those insights to uncover the chemical processes of respiration, of breathing. Still, all these advances notwithstanding, in 1800, Hippocrates and Galen would have recognized and largely agreed with most medical practice. In 1800, medicine remained what one historian called the withered arm of science. In the 19th century, that finally began to change, and with extraordinary rapidity. Perhaps the greatest break came with the French Revolution, when the new French government established what came to be called the Paris Clinical School. One leader of the movement was Xavier Bichat, who dissected organs, found them composed of discrete types of material often found in layers, and called them tissues. Another was René Laennec, inventor of the stethoscope. Meanwhile, medicine began to make use of other objective measurements and mathematics. This, too, was new. Hippocratic writings had stated that the physician's senses mattered far more than any objective measurement. So despite medicine's use of logic, physicians had always avoided applying mathematics to the study of the body or disease.